Welcome back to the Hip Hop Social Worker Podcast. I'm your host, Christopher Scott. And today I'm joined all the way from Austin, Texas, by Elise Kyogen. Say hi to the people, Elise.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited about this. I'm really excited about talking about athletes and mental health. So.
I found her Instagram account a few years ago when I first created mine. And she has a niche. She's the athletes therapist, you know, and I was like, that's kind of cool. And like at the time, like I really didn't like put it like it wasn't like a thing that I saw a lot. But now, like we see, like NFL and NBA teams are speaking up on mental health and hiring mental health therapists, whether it be LCSWs or LPCs, you know. So and you're already kind of like made your own lane for that. So I feel like that's kind of something that like is that a goal for you to kind of get into that world or kind of like to stay kind of independent.
Well, right now, I primarily have been working in private practice, and, you know, that is the goal that I've been, entertaining in my mind, that I think that would be, really fulfilling. Currently, you know, I'm hopeful, like you're saying, like, as the NBA and the NFL, hire on, like, mental health support, I know, several colleges already do, but I'm just excited about how that will trickle down into lower level athletics and just become more normalized, like hopefully from earlier on. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, a lot of the clients that I do see now have, you know, either for some reason have an injury or have a mental health concern. And many of them have been released maybe from a university. And so I have been enjoying like supporting that that group of folks because while there are places that provide mental health services to their athletic department, like once the athlete is released, like they don't have access to that anymore. And so I've actually kind of been surprised by just how many athletes like find me on their own who don't have access to services. So I think that would be really exciting to go that direction. And then I've also found it really fulfilling so far not working under necessarily like a university or a big business yet. So
yeah, that makes sense. It's like kind of like, you know, a freedom, you know, like I like kind of connecting with the athletes, but also don't want to be like, tied into their mission, you know, so.
Yeah. I feel like in some ways, like you're almost allowed to, advocate more for the athlete and like support them in their advocacy. No, like we were talking about your position and how if you're working like for a corporation or for a team specifically, like how much you get connected to maybe like the other authority figures there and you know, hopefully they have safety and trust the people in authority there, but I find that like I'm able to, you know, encourage them to advocate for themselves and kind of have their best interests in mind as well. So yeah.
Nice. Why did you choose the Wonderful World of Therapy as a career?
I don't know about you, but like I got most of the way through graduate school and then like one day I left just like crying, like what did I get myself into? Why am I doing this? My friend actually called me when I left and I like picked up the phone like crying. They're like, oh my gosh, you know. But it's been really fulfilling. I've been in athletics, but I think it really sparked for me when I was training at a facility and there were athletes like the whole range, right? Weekend warriors to collegiate and professional athletes. And I looked around and I was like, hey, this group like is missing this mental health support. And there are, you know, definitely specific things that I think they could, like, we could benefit from as somebody who's also in that group. Like, hey, like, why isn't this normalized? Like, why isn't this included? And also looking around and just seeing, like, how prevalent, like, eating issues were amongst athletes. And so that really just encouraged me that, you know, I was like, I'm going to go back. I want to help people, specifically athletes. Like, I want to challenge this athletic culture narrative of, like, don't trust your body. Like, don't listen. Don't feel. Like, push through everything. No days off. Like, all of this. And it's like, wait, you know, what if we actually, like took care of ourselves, like, emotionally and mentally, like we do physically? Like, what would, you know, what would change for us? And like, how would that really actually benefit this community? And why, you know, why in a community that's so focused on like having a specialized coach in every area doesn't have coaches in this area? Like, why are there no emotional coaches in this area? You know, why are athletes left to like figure this part out on their own, or like try to push it down for so long until they break? And so that's what really you know, inspired me to go back to school and get into this work. So,
okay. So, and I do, I remember, I didn't play a sport until I got in high school. Mm-hmm. I was already a little behind, and I chose wrestling because wrestling seemed like something that I can do. Like, it seemed pretty like, oh, I can go in there and kind of figure this out. And I do remember there was like some unhealthy techniques to cut weight. You know, luckily, right. I like really cut weight. Like, you know, like I was always kind of content with like, if I'm too heavy, I'll just wrestle up a class. You know, but there's, you know, there's people who like were more competitive than I was, and they were like, you know, city, like, you know, they were like big names in the city, so they couldn't really just get, you know, go from 152 to 160. They had to, if they were 156, they had to cut that weight because people were expecting at 152, you know. So like, so I remember one of my teammates, he cut 4 pounds in like an hour.
Wow.
like he just sat in the back of the bus and he just you know, he just like, he just was moving and
yeah,
he was sweating. Then he had like some hot tamales and he was just spitting, like, and he made weight, you know, he made weight in like in 45 minutes. And I was like, damn. But those kind of like, but those are like I feel like they were like not normalized, but they were just kind of like, you know, like they weren't like frowned upon. It was like you can kind of do what you have to do. You know, like, and like you said, like, you got to push through it, push yourself, you know what I'm saying? If you hurt, get up and, you know, you just keep going. And I feel like, you know, like sometimes that could be a little hard. Like, if that's like your, like, if that's your, like, your daily routine or like your mind, you know what I'm saying? That's like, I feel like that would be like kind of tough to like grow out of. You know, do you see a lot of that, like, when you work with athletes now, like kind of like this, have that mindset of like, yeah, I hurt my ankle, but you know, but I can't quit because I still gotta, you know, still gotta finish my set or whatever.
Yeah, so much of what you're talking about, like things are striking for me. You know, you're right. Like, to what you're saying is like, it's so prevalent. Like, you know, in some ways, it's even encouraged, like disordered, like behaviors, and I think. One of the misconceptions is like that athletes don't struggle with food concerns or body image concerns, and it's just not true. Like, it actually is more prevalent. And so, and I think that's because it's so just like normalized and pervasive, and just like everybody is doing some kind of disordered thing. And then to what you're also speaking about is another group of athletes that I work with a lot are retired athletes. And so what do they do when they're just like, they're done, and now they're like, have done these disordered behaviors for so many years, like, you know, and then we kind of just are like, well, thanks, you know, bye. And so I think that's a whole group that I've enjoyed working with, is like, and encouraging them and like having referrals ready for dietitians and saying like, hey, as a retired athlete, like, this is part of the process. Like, you have to relearn how to eat. You have to relearn how to like engage with your body. And so I think unless an athlete, you know, is told that, and like, it's like, hey, this is something that I think most athletes have to relearn. You know, as activity levels change, or as like you, like in retirement, like just, you're not trying to cut weight in 45 minutes, you know, or whatever it is. Like, and so, you know, I think again, that's often something that they're just kind of left to figure out, and it can trail on, and be really problematic for them, like for the rest of their lives potentially. But I think like the other piece that you're talking about is really pervasive and really, I think, oh, it's so challenging. Like having clients who have played sports on a broken back, and like, you know, and they're encouraged to do that, or like, you know, like really like having to work with clients around, again, advocating for themselves, and like, you know, what is the cost going to be if you go out there too soon? Like, and then my place dealing with like, what's coming up for you, like as you are injured or as you're waiting, you know, all these anxieties. But also like, you know, this new place of advocating for themselves, because as much as we hope that coaches advocate, like a lot of the times people in sports like have their own agendas. So yeah, I think that's really common, and I think it's amazing how many, you know, then athletes make it to my office who have been injured so many times, and then they're like let go, and never did advocate for themselves along the way, and saying like, I don't think my body's ready yet, you know, like it needs more time. So it's really a tough culture, I think. As much as we like to think like sports aren't really that healthy a lot of the time, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like, but there's like the perception of like an athlete is like the healthiest person, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so I remember, I hate to like, you know, we're off topic, but my coach, you know, saying, may you rest in peace. I remember he told us that, like, you know, if we were hurt, don't go to the doctor first, come see him first. And mm-hmm. He'll let us know if we can compete.
Yeah.
Right. You know, but he was like an Olympic wrestler. So his level of competition was different than like, you know, high school. So,
yeah.
So what kind of barriers, you know, like are you, like, do you see when you kind of, like, work with clients? Like, I'm sure, you know what I'm saying, like, every athlete isn't like, oh, yeah, I'll take your advice with no problem. I'm sure there's some pushback, and there's some coaches probably calling you, like, hey, can you not do this? Or so what kind of barriers are you seeing, like, you know, in this like, lane you're in?
Yeah. I think, you know, and one of the things I love about your page and your work is just addressing barriers and like really encouraging people to overcome those. And like you've talked about, like, there are barriers for men seeking therapy. There are additional barriers for Black men or women or people of color to seeking therapy. And then, you know, being an athlete is going to be another barrier. Of this athletic culture of, you know, just press it down, like don't push through it. But also all these other pieces of, what does this mean for my playing time? Like, are they going to tell me that I have to sit out? You know, what if this is like my only way that I'm able to afford college? What does this mean for the next year? Like, if I have to sit, you know, if I deal with this now in this season, what does that mean for next season? And so I think there are so many barriers. And then, you know, just that coaches have a lot of, they have a lot of pull, they have a lot of weight. And you know, how supportive are coaches with athletes seeking this kind of support? And so, you know, I think looking at, each individual athlete may have like so many multiple layers of barriers, and some may have more access than others, and there may be fewer barriers. And then some may have like just layers and layers of barriers that they would have to get through. And that's, I think that's one of the great things about like athletic departments having on staff like mental health, or like you're talking about NBA, NFL, like normalizing it, have on staff mental health. Because you know, it's like, okay, if your dietitian and your physical therapist and your mental health therapist are all in the same place, like how much more normalized that is, like how much easier it is to just go there and access it, especially if other people like on your team are doing that. So yeah, I think, you know, like we have to also consider like each individual may have so many more barriers than some other athletes as well. So I think that's really hard. And then just like treatment disparities about, you know, misconceptions about certain things, like, oh, you know, like for example, like the misconception that eating issues are only like a young white female thing, you know, that's another barrier. So then the, you know, like somebody who like I've heard, I mean, I think men in general in athletics like have they're at the same level of risk of like eating concerns. But there's just a barrier of like, hey, I'm not represented in that narrative. I'm not represented in that treatment field. Like if I Google online, people like me aren't gonna be online with this issue, you know? And so yeah, I think there's so many barriers, like depending on what issue people are struggling with, and then also like their individual barriers that they may have.
Yeah. I was just, when you're talking about barriers, you're talking about like how you mentioned how I'm going to play for college or pay for college. Mm-hmm. When I was in high school, I watched Friday Night Lights in the movie theater. Mm-hmm. I remember actually like crying when I think it was named Booby, he got in the car and he was like, mm-hmm. to ask Uncle, like, you know, like, what are we going to do now? You know, like, and they were like, yeah, you know, banking on, like, he was, well, I don't know if his family was banking on it, but he was banking on taking care of his family, you know, like, you know, I'm sure his uncle wasn't going to, like, you know, kick him out for not playing football, but, you know, he took it upon himself to, you know, he's going to use his talent, you know, saying to get him out of the situation. Have you kind of clients that were like, you know, like they came in, they had these big grandiose ideas of making it to the NFL, getting paid, getting their family out, but then they kind of falter? Like, have you had to deal with those kind of clients?
Yeah, it's so hard. Like I've seen clients who, again, like maybe they were out of state. And this was how their family was able for them to go to school out of state. And once they weren't on team, like they had to move like states. They had to like, you know, go to a whole new school. And this is like, even before, like, you know, this is them dealing with this loss of a dream before they even are able to think about Olympics or professional. And I think, you know, I have worked with several athletes who, you know, were on their way there, and because of injuries, like they weren't able to complete that dream or like fill that. And also just like statistically, like 1%, like we're talking about 1% of people making it into like professional sports. You know, the odds are against them, and so yes, that I think, you know, then this big identity piece comes in of like, I've spent my whole life and it's just over like that. Or, you know, like, well, now who am I? Like, who am I without this? And, you know, what is even my future now? Like, I wasn't ready for this. I wasn't thinking about, you know, plan B or whatever. Like, and so, yeah, I think so much, like depression, identity issues, anxiety, comes up there. And you know, even just with like the situational changes of like, you know, a young college age student, like that's a big change to like have to leave the state that you're living in, leave all the friends that you made, like move to another state, try to like figure out a new path at a university where you're no longer a student athlete. Like these are really like big changes, especially as student athletes, like spending most of your time with other athletes or and so yeah, I think
technical difficulties. Sorry. you know, it being like kind of like a kind of a hotbed for a lot of tension right now. You know, how do you like, you know, you being like a white practitioner, how do you like create the space for black clients of color that you know that might be experiencing some like, you know, disparities at their colleges with their organization, because those things are real, you know. Mm-hmm. how do you create that space to kind of make them feel welcoming and inviting?
Mm-hmm. I think so. I feel like this is such a big question, and there are so many like intricate pieces to this, but some of my thoughts on it are that one, I think this is so important for so many reasons, that like understanding the history of our field and understanding the history of white clinicians in our field and like the trauma that we've caused, I think it's really important to know about that, and so there's I think for so many reasons, it's important that we work to provide a safe and supportive space, and also, and particularly with my work, a lot of the times we're talking about body image and about food concerns and things like that, and so knowing like my body just entering the room brings a lot of privilege. There's a lot of things about my body that bring a lot of privilege. And so I think it's really important that I, do this work and that I am constantly growing in this area, especially when we're talking about bodies. And so I think first saying that, like, I don't consider myself an expert in this area at all. Like, I just know that like I have constant work to do in this area, and I'm sure like there, you know, thinking back, like I can think where I'm like, oh man, like yeah, that was an area where you still needed work or things like that, and so I just know that like I'm ever having to learn and grow in this area, but I think what's important to me or what I have done is I've started in my personal life, and I think the therapy room needs to be a place of healing for the client, like focused on that and not focused on like my growth or my understanding or my racial identity. Like that is not the time and place. And you know, gratefully, like this process started for me many, many years ago. And so in my personal life, like spending time in places where the majority of people are not white, I think is really important. And like having the experience of, you know, having people of authority over me who are not white, whether it's pastors or coaches or, you know, medical professionals or other providers, like, I think it's really important. Like to me, I like to make sure that I'm not just seeing all white female medical providers. Mm. And that, you know, like specifically I've spent a lot of time in a predominantly black church. And so like, I think that was really helpful for me to understand like how exhausting it is to be the only person, or like everyone knows if you show up that day to church or not, you know, and like those things like that most of the time, like we don't, like as white bodies, like we don't have to experience that. And also, like I was saying, like having people of authority over me, like believing other people's experiences, like being subject to their knowledge, like and learning from them, I think is really important. And also having like-minded white people that I can process things with, or that can challenge me, or, you know, and I have a really great friend, Mallory, who is also a clinician who is like-minded, and I feel like I learned so much from her, where she can, like, call me out on things, or, like, you know, gently encourage me or educate me, and we can have a place to process, like, emotions or feelings about certain things that don't belong in other areas or placed on other people, and so I think that the media I consume, so these are all just things that, like, I think in my personal life, like, translates to the therapy room. And you have posted something before about, like, the layers of, or the different, like, categories of racism. And I think this is so, I think this is so important, because as someone, like, who's, you know, conditioned under white supremacy, like, understanding, like, how do these different layers, like, show up in the room, like, the individualized, like, biases that I have, that the client has, and then, like, interpersonal interactions, like, you know, I think it's, you have to, I think, like, making sure you are not committing microaggressions, and, like, you know, you do therapy, like, sometimes clients can just kind of go on and on and on, and sometimes you have to kind of interject, but, you know, having, like, I need to be careful as a white female, like, interrupting somebody, like, it's not the same, and so, like, delicately knowing, like, is that even helpful for the therapeutic process if I interject right now, or if I slow them down, like, where is that harmful, and just in these little ways, like, hey, before we go on, can I hear more about this, versus, like, let me stop you, you know, like, there's little ways that I feel like are very important to making sure, like, interpersonally, like, that the client feels safe, and that I'm, like, providing support or not, like, causing more harm, and then I think, like, you have, like, the, like, institutionalized racism, right? And so if I'm, like, referring out, like, am I referring to people who are safe? Like, you know, if I have to send to a treatment center, like, what is their experience going to be like there? Like, understanding, like, just how, you know, like, are my referrals, like, representative, and things like that? And then just, like, the culture at large, and, you know, having discussions, like, with clients, like, and I don't usually have to do this with white clients, but, like, I, you know, when you're doing a welfare check, you call the police. Well, I don't think that I feel safe calling police on a black client, you know, and, like, we have discussions about this, and, like, does this mean, like, we involve your family more? Like, what does this look like for us so that you're safe, so that, like, what I do to help provide support for you isn't gonna cause more harm, like, and I have these discussions with clients, like, early on, like, first or second session, and bringing up, like, you know, I think it's important, as a white clinician, for me to bring up race, just so that people know, like, hey, I'm open to talking about this, like, I think it's important, you know, that things are going to connect back to this. Like, I want you to feel safe to bring this up. And so, you know, usually in the first or second session, like, if it is not a white identifying or a white client or a white passing client, like, have this discussion of, I don't have the understanding, like, of a clinician who may identify similarly to you. Like, you know, are there parts of, you know, if there are parts of, like, my identity, or, like, if you're not able to do the work here that you need to do, like, let's find someone that can support you in that. And so, you know, just having this, like, discussion early on about, I want you to bring that into the room. I want to, I want to see like how this is part of all of the things that are going on, race and racism. And I obviously like reassuring the client like that you believe them. I think there's so much value in also like not thinking that every client has the same experience based on race or ethnicity or something like that, right? Like I think as a white clinician, like having to be very mindful of like you don't know and don't assume. Like this person is a unique person. Like even if I have to like straight tell myself that in my mind, like remember this is a unique person. Like what is their experience? Like why don't you just like being curious about like their experience of that and like what is going on for them, you know, I think is so important as a white clinician. Yeah, those are some things. I don't know if you want to interject. Oh, I could keep rambling.
It's all good. You know, I'm not really a person that likes to interrupt. You know, so. but yeah, I feel like you have some good points, especially like the not assuming, or like the worst part, like why I think why people like fear, not fear, but like just don't want to like don't want to like kind of step into that space. If they don't have to, because a lot of times, like, you know, like I might say something's racist and then a white person might say, are you sure? Then it's like, I don't really want to, you know, like, what do you mean? Am I sure?
Yeah.
Like, of course, like I'm sure. So like, and you mentioned like, you know, say don't assume kind of, you know, and this, and then you bring it up first. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like that's, you know, I feel like that's fair. You know what I'm saying? Because I mean, it is tough because, like, I feel like as a black person, like I'm already assuming that somebody who doesn't look like me is not gonna get where I'm coming from, you know.
Yeah.
And it's all right for you to say I don't get where you're coming from, but you know, but still, like, you know, let me hear more, you know. And don't have like the the savior position or the expert position. It's like, you know, like
right.
We're here to create a, you know, like a space that's helpful, not harmful. So.
Yeah. I think that, we need so many more, therapists who are black, full color, like especially men. Because there's obvious work that like a white clinician can't do or like can't provide. And there's so much value and benefit to, you know, for people like being able to meet with somebody who already understands or has like similar life experience, or, you know, that just provides a safety that, you know, a white clinician can't provide. Sometimes I think that there is a value if done safely, correctly, and in a way that is not harmful. Like if I'm meeting with clients, who are people of color who like to have this space where, as a white woman, my feelings aren't in the room and I'm holding this space for you. And like, I am wanting to hear more about your experience. And especially when, if we're talking about body, again, like, you know, a place where they can say, hey, I've been told I needed to look like you my whole life, or people like you, like who look like you have harmed me in this way. And I think there can be a real healing aspect to me, like, being able to say, like, that's so messed up and I believe you. And I want to hear about that, and I want to, like, support you and not be defensive. Like, just, like, listen and be like, yeah, that's messed up. Like, and for to provide this opportunity for basically someone to say, like, I've been told, like, I need to look like you, my whole, like have your, you know, blonde hair, like, you know, thin privilege, whatever it is, like, my whole life. And so a place for them to, like, kind of wrestle with that. And in a sense, like, you know, I don't take up any space there, I think can be really healing if you know, as long as it's done safely and in a way where there's, like, education and understanding and, like, you know, curiosity and yeah, like all the other things that we've talked about. Yeah.
Definitely. Is there a lot of Black clinicians in your area?
There are like practices where there are clinicians of color. I think that, you know, there are a handful of Black clinicians in our area. I wouldn't say there are a lot. And especially like in the area that I specialize with eating concerns, like we always need like more Black clinicians, more Black dietitians. Like, it's definitely an area where there's just not enough. Like I think being like prepared with resources for clients for clinicians who are people of color or Black clinicians like is important, but I would say there's not enough. Yeah.
Sounds like Oregon.
Yeah.
Handful of us, you know, we all kind of like, you know, are in the same like kind of network, but like when you see like the grand scheme of therapists, it's like, oh, it's not a lot of us, but it feels like it's a lot of us because I feel like, but I think it's because I'm a social worker and I kind of know where to find people at, like I can find them, you know, so okay, thanks for that response. And you say you specialize in eating disorders and in athletes. So is that like your super niche? Just like, you know, you do athletes, but like the eating disorder part is like the super, like it's kind of what you like kind of drive your, you know, your practice into.
Yeah. So I work with a wide range of things with athletes. And I want to say like, I think, understanding the culture and being able to like communicate like therapy jargon into athlete jargon is really helpful and important. And so I, you know, and a lot of the times like what we're talking about may not be sport related. I think eating concerns are a specialty like that where I've sought like additional training and has been my area like a focus, although I do work with anxieties or depression or relationship issues or other things like that, I've done more training, like tried to make eating concerns like you said, like a sub niche too. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So when it's all said and done, what would you want for people to say about like, you know, beliefs and their practice?
What would I want people to say about my practice?
You know, like, you know, like, you know, your contribution to the field.
I haven't really thought about this. Like, that's such a good question. Which I think I need to be thinking about more. I think I want people to think that I am a provider who cares about social justice issues. Like I care about treatment disparities. I care about educating and getting the word out of like, you know, there's a problem if only one group of people are receiving treatment or something. Like, educating people on how do you like support all of your athletes. I think I want people to see me as someone who like advocates for the athlete and that I hope that in their time working with me, like that they, you know, learn to advocate for themselves and that, you know, they find like, you know, like the recovery and the healing that was in them, like they had that. And so I just, you know, like, to be witness to that, I think is really powerful. And so I just hope that like, you know, it's a place where people can become more fully themselves. And just like, yeah, I think like advocating for themselves and really like caring about their mind and body and emotions, like truly like getting in tune with those. Yeah, I like that. I'll have to keep thinking about that. That's a really good question.
Yeah, well, you know, like in when we're building our brands up, you know, like those kind of things, we gotta think about, you know, saying like, what do you want people to say about, you know, you and your brand, you know? So like, you know, when it's all said and done, you know, like what kind of impact do you, you know, do you want, you know, to leave? Now I'm gonna assume you were an athlete yourself. Were you an athlete?
Yeah. So I ran track in high school and then did wakeboarding all through college. And then I trained at a facility post-college with a bunch of athletes. And so I was not like a D1, like, superstar. I was a D1 player. But I think this is like, you know, as you're asking me about, like, what does it take to be a therapist for athletes? Like, this is an important piece of, like, understanding the culture, understanding, like, the language, like immersing yourself in that, like understanding, like having like experiences of working with maybe a difficult coach or working with in an environment where you're told to like cut weight in 45 minutes or whatever it is, like and so yeah, I think that I've learned a lot from my experience as an athlete, even without having, like, you know, become a professional athlete or something like that, like yeah, I think pulling from my experience to like understand the culture, understand the language, like understand the specific barriers and needs and things like that.
Yeah. And do you like, so like, do you wish you had more like emotional support or like, or did you have emotional support as an athlete or, you know, like what was the deal?
Yeah, I feel like, not at all. You know, I feel like that is why, you know, I kind of sought it out on my own, and actually was discouraged by, like, coaches about seeking my own support. And so I think, you know, that is one thing that has inspired me to, like, do this work is, like, there are people who, like, we need the support in this area. This, like, to be more normalized, like you're saying, like what impact would I like to have, like reducing stigma, like normalizing this, like bringing this to the athletic culture, like challenging some of those narratives and actually, like, hopefully shifting it in some way to actually be a healthier, like, culture for people. So yeah, no, I was not encouraged to seek support, you know, and so but I think that's why I'm like, no, I'm going to do this, like, and I'm going to become this, so.
Yeah, it's crazy that there's not, like, you know, like there's, like, that kind of just, like this model of just, you know, tough it out, you know. My coach used to tell me something, I forgot what the phrase was, but, you know, but just really, like, just kind of, like, you know, just tough it out, you know. So, like, I know you hurt right now, but. You know, just, it's like, but that's so, like, it just leaves, like, so many, like, you know, because, you know, we're all different, you know, and
yeah.
You know, some people are gifted athletes, and some people have to work 10 times harder, you know, and it is okay to work harder, but I feel like you should still have, like, support of, like, somebody who's taking care of you emotionally and mentally.
Yeah. Well, and I think that I agree with you so much, and, like, this is a hot topic, and I'm sure, like, I'll get backlash for bringing this up, but, like, you know, even looking at, like, professional athletes of, like, Kawhi Leonard, like, while there may be other things going on about him sitting out, like, he recovered from his injury and went on to win, like, NBA championship. And then we look at KD, who, like, as a professional athlete, like, he didn't play basketball for, like, a year, and, like, you know, there's millions on the line, and he feels this pressure to, like, play on an injury before he's ready, you know, and, like, that's not, I know, mental health, but, like, all these pressures and, like, the fear of advocating for ourselves, like, the fear of actually listening to our bodies as athletes, the fear, you know, and there was so much backlash for Kawhi, like, not playing and stuff like that, and so anyways, like, you know, obviously, like, we can keep seeing, like, the rates of, unfortunately, like, suicide in athletes or, you know, all these other mental health issues that something is not being addressed, like, something is missing, and like, why is there pushback on people receiving support in this area? How do we sell this? Unfortunately, it's a lot about, like, performance, like, to sell it to coaches or even to athletes sometimes, which it should just be about, like, the health of the athlete, but we have to kind of, like, you know, I think sell it as in, like, this will improve performance, you know, but, like, why does it take all of this to get support for athletes, you know? It's really unfortunate and challenging, but then there's more work to be done, I guess.
Definitely. Yes. Yeah, I remember that, you know, Kawhi getting kind of like the just people just not, you know, and I didn't even think about, like, in that aspect. I was like, you know, I was kind of thinking, like, you know, well, the year's shot, so, like, why come back? But then, mm-hmm. like, you never know, like, if he doesn't feel supported on that team, you know what I'm saying? Like, why would he come back? And, like, why mm-hmm. are we talking about, like, that part of it, you know? Like, you know, because that probably is hurtful to hear, like, you know, because was the narrative that, like, his coaches were saying kind of, like, stuff about him, and he just was kind of – he was hurt, but he was like, well, yeah. Why would I put myself through that, you know? So,
yeah. The, like, team environment and the environment provided by coaches, like, have such an impact on athletes. And I've seen, like, athletes, like, really, like, do well, like, you know, under certain, like, cultures within their team. And then other athletes, like, you know, top down, like, the culture, it's really hard to, like, you know, if you're facing racism and you're depressed and then that turns into performance anxiety, like, it's kind of, like, almost like having to get out of that culture in some ways or that team dynamic sometimes, you know, like, it's really tough, yeah.
Yeah. And I never even thought about that, too. Like, you know, like, there's sometimes where you just see a player, like, having a slump. Like, why? Like, what the hell happened? He was killing, and then something could be going on, you know? Like,
yeah. Well, and you make a great point, like, how we dehumanize athletes. And that's another piece of, like, a barrier to getting emotional support is, like, completely dehumanizing them, you know, certainly exploiting their bodies, especially you're talking about, like, Black athletes, exploiting, like, the Black athlete body. And, you know, we just, like, athletes are so dehumanized. You know, there's always, like, this, like, oh, this is amazing. This athlete is playing this game after, like, their family member died. It's like, why are we glorifying that? Like, why aren't they allowed a day to grieve or a day off? Like, why are they out here? Like, some athlete talking about, like, you know, my wife had just miscarried. I just had a miscarriage and I'm playing the game. Why am I out here? You know, like, why do we dehumanize them so much? And why are they not allowed to have, like, their emotions? And there's so much politics that go into it as well. But, you know, I think it's just another aspect of, like, why it makes it hard for them to get support for mental health.
Yeah, true. Yeah. So, we definitely got to talk about sports culture and. Where can people find you at?
So I am on Instagram at athlete_therapist. That's pretty much the only, like, social that I'm at right now. My website is counselingforathletesaustin.com. And yeah, I'm in Austin, Texas, and so my, I guess, Instagram.
All right. Well, I appreciate you for joining me, and explaining your career path and create space and things like that. Such an important conversation, and hopefully, you know, you get the ball rolling on, you know, some mental health services for some of these athletes, you know.
Thank you so much. I really have enjoyed this conversation. I feel like I could talk about this nonstop. And so I appreciate you providing, like, the platform and the space and just your knowledge and wisdom on this and your podcast. Like, how fun. This is cool. Thank you.
No problem. All right. Talk to you later.
All right. Bye.